I want to invite you to turn to John chapter 4. We're continuing our series on snapshots of Jesus. And we're seeing one of my very favorite stories today. And it may be one of yours as well. Do you remember the story of the Samaritan lady? I want to introduce it in a little bit different way. And I want to do it by giving you the title of the sermon, which is Glee. Now, glee has a lot of meanings in our culture and our society. This is from a dictionary reference. Glee, a noun, open delight or pleasure, hilarity, mirth, jubilant delight, joy. And I like that. Now, there's another definition of glee, and probably it has something to do with this definition, but did you ever go to a high school or college where they would have a group of singers together, and they would sing, and they would perform, and they'd regularly practice, and they typically enjoyed what they did a lot? As a matter of fact, that joy was reflected in the name of the club. What was the name of the club? The Glee Club, absolutely. And so it was a rallying point for people who had musical gifts, who enjoyed singing, and it was just a lot of fun. Interesting enough, a little bit over 10 years ago, when my oldest daughter was in high school, there was a TV show that came out with that name called Glee. And I remember going to South Dakota, Spearfish, South Dakota. I spent a week with a church up there just trying to encourage them. And the family I was staying with had a couple teenage daughters, and I'll never forget the mother was asking me what I thought about this TV program, Glee. And I had never heard of it, but the premise was basically one where you had different kids in this high school who performed together in a Glee club. But what was interesting was a couple things. Number one, typically, they were misfits in that high school. And then, secondly, they actually sounded really good. That's because they hired professional actors and actresses. But it kind of swept the culture. It was on Fox, and they did a good job advertising it. And I watched a couple of episodes after that mother gave me a heads up because I wanted to see what all the talk was. And they definitely pushed an agenda that I thought was really harmful about sexuality and teenagers. But I did appreciate their instincts, which was this, particularly in a society where at the time we didn't know the emotional damage that these newfangled instruments called smartphones were doing to our young people. But it really, I think, connected with many of the young people in our country because they really, whether they were or not, they felt like misfits. And they felt out of place, and so they were yearning for some group where they could feel in place. And I watched that, and I thought about the gospel message. Because isn't it true that when you go through the gospels, one of the impacts you see in Jesus as he spreads his good news is it connects with people who feel like they are misfits. And they hear the call of God. And they see Jesus, and they sense the love of God, and they sense the chance for community, and they want to be a part of that. And as a matter of fact, I preached a sermon to my church during that time where I tried to redeem the name Glee and change it into God's love expressed everywhere. Because I think that's really the message of the Gospel of John as you track Jesus. It's God's love expressed everywhere. And it's a call, especially those who feel like they are misfits. Come together in this community, and you will experience God's redemption, God's love, and you will go from being misfit to fit, and you will fit in nicely. Isn't that the message of Luke 14? Jesus says, the people who feel like they fit in, they don't want to be a part of me. They don't want to be part of this banquet. Here, you, go out to the highways and the byways, find the lame, the blind, find the misfit, and call them into the table. That's always been the call of Jesus. And it's a great call. And if you look at this story here, you may have the queen of the misfits. Do you remember this Samaritan woman? If you look in chapter 4, Jesus and his disciples are going to go to Galilee. They're going to leave Judea and go to Galilee. But normally what they do as good Jews is they take a side road. And it's like, rather than going as a crow flies, which the road would take them if they wanted to take it, they could just go straight ahead to their destination. No, they practically go at a 45-degree angle. No, that's 90 degrees, isn't it? 90 degrees. Never was good at geometry. Well, he never was. And then they go up there and then take another left, another hard 90 degrees, and then they head toward their destination. Why? Well, they wanted to avoid the land of Samaria. Why? Because it was a land of the misfits. They couldn't stand them, right? Remember why we have the Samaritans in the land of Samaria? Anybody remember the captivities in the Old Testament? Remember these invading armies would come in and they'd find all the best and the brightest of the Jews and they'd capture them and march them to wherever it was, Babylon or wherever they were taking them. And then they would try to turn them into good subjects. Daniel's a good example of that. And the ones they pursued weren't so smart, weren't so bright, weren't so competent, they'd leave behind. The ones they looked at as misfits. Now, these invaders would leave an army just to make sure they maintained order. And guess what these soldiers would do? A lot of times they would impregnate or intermarry with these people who were left behind, with these Jews who were left behind. And sooner or later, God would redeem his people. They'd march back. Remember, that's a great story in the Old Testament, Nehemiah, for example. And they'd come back and they'd find these misfits and they would say, What were you thinking? Why in the world did you intermarry with these invading soldiers, these outcasts, these people who are anathema to God? And I suppose the people who stayed said, well, you took off and left us high and dry, and we're just trying to survive. And they'd fight and everything. And ultimately, the Samaritans just got their own location. The Samaritans were the ones who were the misfits, part Jew, part Gentile, but out of place. And the good Jews would avoid having anything to do with them. And by the way, it's vice versa. Out of the pain, I'm sure the Samaritans felt, they didn't want anything to do with the Jews. Well, here's Jesus with his disciples. What does Jesus do? He leads them right through Samaria. And so the disciples are, it's almost like a scary movie where you kind of hear some of that background music that's alerting you to the fact that something scary is fixing to happen. They don't feel comfortable. They might as well be in a haunted house. They don't feel comfortable anyway. And then Jesus settles down at a well. I mean, they're hot, they're tired, they're thirsty, they're hungry. And it says in verse 6, Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired as he was from the journey, sat down by the well. It was about the sixth hour. When a Samaritan woman came to draw water, Jesus said to her, will you give me a drink? His disciples had gone into town to buy food. So Jesus was by himself. He's at a well, and this Samaritan woman comes to the well. Now, know what you know about her. What's the story behind her coming at the well at this time of day? Do you remember? This wasn't normal, was it? They normally came either early in the morning or late in the evening. But she didn't come with the other women. Why? Well, this misfit in the land of misfits is isolated. You have to be pretty misfit if you can't even fit in with the misfits, right? And she doesn't. She doesn't. And we find out she's been married and divorced several times. And she's shacking up right now with somebody. And so even the misfits ostracize her. Now, what I wanted to do is I really want to get into how Jesus reaches out to her with the good news. Because I think it's helpful. But I want to set it up. I want to set it up well because I one of the things I sense in churches usually is people deeply desire to share the gospel, but they really feel like they're misfit for the mission, pun intended. And by that, I don't mean outcast, but I mean they just don't feel like they're up to the task. Either I don't know enough or I don't have the skills to do so. And so consequently, a lot of times, opportunities pass them by. And one of the things I really want to try to do to encourage you is I want to bust this myth that you have to be a super salesman to be a great evangelist for Christ. As a matter of fact, I think if you look at Jesus, most of the time he doesn't practice super sales techniques. Indeed, I really want to spend some time hitting his home because it was so hard for me to get this. And I want to do this in a little laboratory. One of the things I have learned through the years is I'm a very bad salesman. I really am. And part of the reason is I have booby-trapped myself a lot of times. And what happens is, I'm trying to do better about this, and I think I am, but I'm so passionate about what I believe in and so enthusiastic, I just absolutely smother people on the other side. And I'll give you a real-life example here. Superintendents, with what I try to do to take care of people and have a team take care of people, I try to convince superintendents we can really help you help your people, especially your teachers. The burnout rate, I don't know if you know this, but it's really high. And just did awful with them, and I couldn't figure out what was going on. And let me just give you a quick lab to show you what I think what I was doing that was bad and what I learned from that. And I need a volunteer. Can I have a volunteer? Yes, sir. Well, thank you. Yes. You'd be great. Thank you. Would you? Yes, the man in the blue shirt here. Yes, would you come up here for a second? Have a seat. And this will be painless. Only 1 out of 10 volunteers have died doing this. But I'm working toward stereotypes with the gospel, but I'm going to start with something more general, non-gospel, okay? Hello, sir. How you doing? Mark Edge. What is your name?
Alan McNeil.
Alan, nice to meet you. And hey, thanks a lot for letting me come in and talk to you about your school and your teachers. And I noticed that you had one of the highest turnover rates in the state. You got almost 30% of your teachers that are leaving. Every time they walk out of the door, that's $20,000 or $30,000 of taxpayers' money. And I know you care about that, and I know you care about them. And let me tell you something. What we do is really give you a chance to show that you care for your people through us, and we put our arms around them and just walk through their problems. We don't solve them, but we just say, hey, we're here for you. And if they need clinical help, we got counselors. And by golly, when we first started Chick-fil-A, the first year, their turnover rate was reduced by 29%, and the retention rate increased by 9%, and they were just so thrilled. And we can do that for you guys. And okay, I'm being a little fast with this. It was a little bit more drawn out. But do you already sense a problem that I didn't sense? What do you think Alan is feeling here? Are you feeling smothered? Yeah, and now I will give myself credit for this. I usually stand up over them and do that. But I was talking to a friend a few years ago who's known me for 40 years. I said, you know, I just really can't figure out what's going on with this. And he said, well, and he was, you know, he's a good friend. He kind of led me through thoughts and questions, but very low key. Even though he's a high-strung guy like I am, he said, you know, when people come in who are salespeople, and they're really, really enthusiastic about what they're selling, I tend to turn them off and feel like I'm just wondering, how are they trying to take me? How are they trying to use me? And I start thinking, oh, wow, what I thought was passion, enthusiasm, and they weren't, a lot of people probably weren't taking it that way. It was like, okay, what's this? How's this guy trying to snooker me? I mean, almost immediately, probably some folks were just turned off by that. Even though my motives were, and I believed everything I said. Okay? So, from that, one of the things I try to do now, when I do, whoever it is I just say to myself, I'm going to be an introvert. I don't like people. I don't want to be with people. I don't want to talk with people. So I just come in, sit down. Now I'm going to stop this here because I don't know how long it'll take before Alan says something. But I want to try to pretend like I'm the world's greatest introvert. And I've got a brother-in-law who's got a brother that I knew in college that you know, if you don't talk in a conversation, nothing's happening. And that's what I try to picture myself. Now, am I doing that to be a hypocrite? No. I'm just doing that to try to make a connection with people.
I'd have probably said call security.
You know, there's sometimes I'm tempted just to come in and almost go, sir, like, you know, I don't want to sell you anything. What do you even have me in here for? You know, just any kind of reverse psychology. And I realize that's ridiculous, although, and you're welcome to take your seat now. See, you survived. Thank you very much. Although, what I have noticed is, I can't tell you how many people I baptized that I didn't want to baptize because then it wasn't convenient to my schedule. I remember in Argentina, one Sunday night, we had once a week services over Sunday night, 3 or 4 hours of Bible class and services, 2 or 3, man. But I couldn't wait till afterwards because we were ahead a couple hours in the United States. And guess what was coming on that night for the first time ever in Argentina? The Super Bowl. And guess who was playing? Dallas and Buffalo. And so we're finishing right when they're getting ready to start. And guess what? 2 people out of the blue that we'd been studying with off and on for years said, we want to be baptized. I was like, are you kidding me? The Super Bowl's about to come on of all the time. I didn't say that, but anyway, I don't know what that is, but it seems like sometimes when, whether it's Christianity or sales with the stuff that I do, it's almost like there's a correlation. I tend to do better if I don't want to sell it to them than I do. It's almost like people start asking me questions. Converted Jehovah's Witness. The only Jehovah's Witness I ever converted was a kid who wouldn't leave me alone, a college student. I thought he was using me to learn English. And he probably was to begin with, somewhat, but he also had kind of an intrigue about how we practice Christianity versus what he saw in the Jehovah's Witness group. And he's a minister in Argentina today, by the way. Has been for 20 years. So, you may be going, what in the world was that all about? Well, what I want you to know is, as a matter of fact, if you are an introvert and feel out of place sharing the gospel, you're probably the perfect candidate to share the gospel. It's people like me who tend to do worse or do more damage than people like you. Because have you ever put something in the microwave and cooked it too fast? People don't cook well fast. They need to percolate. And so if you are an introvert, if you feel ill-equipped to share the gospel, you're actually probably the perfect one to share the gospel. Because people need time to process. It's got to percolate. And all that to say, I want you to look at what Jesus does here. You're very familiar with the story. But notice how he goes about it. Including the fact, this is almost in the category of, I don't want to sell you anything, why you have me here? But what he starts out with is, now if we were on a spring break campaign or a mission trip, probably what we would do in verse 7 is, hey, let me get this for you. Let me take this water back to your place. Can I get this for you? Here, I brought some other water pots too. I'm going to take you a whole week's supply of water. You know, Jesus doesn't do that. He doesn't say, hey, let me serve you. Instead, he says, what? Can you serve me? Now, wait a minute. I thought this is he wants to be great, let him be a servant guy. Yeah, he is. However, one of the great ways he's able to serve this lady was to start out saying, could you serve me? See, people aren't widgets. There's not one size fits all. They're more like a 1,000-piece puzzle where each piece, you may think initially they're all the same, but they're not. There's a lot of shapes to them. And I think one of the geniuses of Jesus was his ability to discern when to ask somebody for a drink and when to offer a drink. Now, verse 9, the Samaritan woman said to him, you are a Jew, and I am a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink? You got there the little parenthesis for Jews do not associate with Samaritans. Let me just real quickly say this as we talk about God's love expressed everywhere. You know, you guys are biblical scholars, and I'm not trying to be practice flattery, but I mean, in our culture, you are biblical scholars, no question about it. You know more about the Bible, you've studied more about the Bible, so I want to take a little moment to do a little Bible class stuff, if that's okay, because I think that this is where you live anyway. But let me remind you of something you probably already know, but you got low place Samaritans on the totem pole, right? Now, how can you be lower than that? Well, you can be a woman. As a matter of fact, the rabbis back then had a saying, it's better to teach the law to a dog than it is to a woman. Now, see, you thought there were male chauvinists today who are pretty bad. Well, go back to those Pharisees and Sadducees of the times of Jesus, and those guys were pretty male chauvinistic. But it was even worse in this case, because not only was she a woman, but what kind of woman was she? Okay, Jesus said that the stones will shout out if people don't answer. So let me try the walls. What kind of woman was she? Samaritan woman. That's right. That's right. Thank you, walls. And even worse than that, not only was she a Samaritan woman, but morally speaking, what kind of woman was she? Yes. For that culture, about as immoral as you can get. And so, you've got Jesus speaking to this misfit, and they really want us to know this is a misfit. And you have in verse 10, when she asked this guy, this rabbi, Jesus, a question, how can you ask me for a drink? Jesus answered her, if you knew the gift of God, who is it that asked you for a drink? You would have asked him, and he would have given you living water. Now, I want you to notice what he does here. Does he pour out the kit and the caboodle all at one time here? Does he say, you know what, I am so glad you asked me that, because back in the beginning I was here, I existed before you existed, I helped create the world, and here's my story, and you know, 5 hours later you pick it up. Okay, now that takes us through Nehemiah. Let me get us toward about, no, he doesn't, he just little bitty snippets. Right? Little bitty snippets. Very, knowing what he knows, you look and you think, okay, he is very reserved in what he's sharing. Very limited. You ever watch a bird, a mama bird feed a baby bird? It's just little, and that's what he's doing here. Look at what she says in verse 11. Sir, the woman said, you have nothing to draw the well with, and the well's deep. Where can you get this living water? Now, whatever he said has kind of intrigued her. You know, he hasn't in one fell swoop said, listen, let me tell you about your moral life. You need to get it together, okay? I mean, we live in a nation that has got moral catastrophe here, and what you need to do is to leave this guy you're with or marry him, but get your life. No, he didn't go into moral teaching. Now, is moral teaching important? Absolutely. Does it contribute to the downfall of society? You bet. But right now, all he's doing is he's pointing at something that's right there, living water, and say, you know, that reminds me of something. And here he goes. Now, look at verse 12. Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us this well and drank from it himself, as did his sons and his flocks and his herds? So she knows something about the Bible. She's had some teaching in the Bible. The Samaritans did study what we call the Old Testament scriptures. Jesus answered, verse 13, everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again, but whoever drinks the water I give him will never thirst. Indeed, the water I give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life. Now, have you noticed that he is not going on this long sermon, but rather answering the question? And a lot of times what he does is kind of like these podcasts today. He preps and prompts for the next one, kind of teases a little bit, get her to want to find out more. But just little portions. He piques her curiosity and gets her to think ahead. What is this living water? And so he's having a conversation. I'm convinced from religion, I'm convinced from politics, convinced from the media. People do want to be persuaded, but they don't want to be preached at. People want to be invited, but they don't want to be coerced. And whether you're on the right or left, whether you're a Christian or an atheist, it applies. And so you notice here that Jesus is not coercing her to follow him. He is inviting her. Can a good introvert do that? Absolutely. Absolutely. Your job is not to push somebody under the water. Your job is to invite them to follow Jesus. And everything else is going to take care of itself. Never forget one time doing a marriage counseling with a couple. She grew up in a church where they sprinkled. He was a good old Church of Christ boy. And basically what he wanted me to do was, while he held her down, he wanted me to beat her with the gospel and beat her into the baptistry. And I wouldn't do it. And interestingly enough, one of the times I guess I actually kind of followed Jesus' technique, but I was very, very subtle, very slow. And she did obey the gospel, ultimately in baptism, but over time and not through a beating. All right. Jesus talks about in 13:14, I am the source of living water. I am the source of eternal life. In verse 15, the woman says, Sir, give me this water so that I won't get thirsty and have to keep coming here to draw water. So now she's thirsting for it. And so, introverts, your job is to very slowly listen to them and listen to the things they're saying that indicate my life is messed up, and build bridges to the gospel. And you can do that. It doesn't take much talking. As a matter of fact, probably less talking, the better. And so here, Jesus is using literally this spring in this situation to build a bridge to the gospel. Now he's got the woman asking more and more questions and basically saying, hey, I want to be baptized. I know the Super Bowl's coming, but I don't care. I'm not a fan of American football anyway. I just want to be baptized into Christ. Verse 16. Does Jesus skirt repentance? No. Look at what he says here. Go call your husband and come back. Pretty subtle, right? He could have said, you adulteress, you foul woman. He could have done gone. No, just, hey, why don't you go get your husband? She says, verse 17, I have no husband. And then Jesus comes clean. You're right when you say you have no husband. The fact is you have five husbands, and the man you're now with is not your husband. What you have just said is quite true. Is the gospel all about making people feel good about continuing a life of sin? No. Unfortunately, we have a lot in our culture today who do believe that's what it is. I don't mean Eastern establishment CNN culture. I mean evangelical church culture. You heard me right. If you haven't heard, just start reading around. More and more of the message of evangelical church culture in America, good old Southern church culture, is let us help you maintain your life of sin and make you feel good about it. We'll sprinkle some Jesus in. That's not the gospel. All right. Look at verse 19. We're going to get to the crux, and then we'll call it a day. Sir, the woman said, I see that you're a prophet. Our fathers worship on this mountain, but you Jews claim the place where we must worship is in Jerusalem. All right. Did you see this lady says, I see that you are a prophet? Because he knows what's going on in her life, and she knows that there's no way he would know that unless he had some kind of prophetic insight. Now she's saying, okay, I get you guys worship in Jerusalem, and we worship here, so who's right? So now they're moving to more doctrine. What does it mean to follow you doctrinally? And Jesus declared, believe me, woman, a time is coming when you will worship the Father, neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You Samaritans worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews. Yet a time is coming, and now has come, when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For they are the kind of worshipers the Father seeks. God is spirit, and his worshipers must worship in spirit and in truth. Now that's a great teaching. I want to get over that to finish up here with something that I think is worth emphasizing. And besides that, you know about God is spirit, and wherever we are in the world, we can worship him. But I want you to catch this in verse 25. Listen to what the lady says. I know the Messiah, called the Anointed One, called Christ. I know he's coming. When he comes, he will explain everything to us. And then for one of the few times, Jesus says, what? I am the Messiah. Now he says it in a very poetic way. I who speak to you am he. But he's basically saying, I am that I am. This is a big revelation. The disciples come back in verse 27. She goes. Why does she leave? Because her life has been changed. She has bought what Jesus is selling. And I'm being crude here. Jesus is not selling. He's not a salesman. And she's not a buyer, but she has been persuaded. And so she goes out to persuade others, to invite them in. I want you to look at verse 39. Many of the Samaritans from that town believed in him. Now she's going out and she's telling them. Many believed in him because of the woman's testimony. Now what is her testimony? Is it, come, find the Lord Christ of God? Or is it, repent and be baptized? No. This is one of the most unbelievable testimonies I have ever seen in Scripture. Here's the testimony. Verse 39. He told me everything I ever did. That's it. Now you would think that wouldn't persuade very many people. But you know the context, right? So here's what's going on. And I'll finish up with this. Jesus knew everything, the most intimate secrets, the greatest sins of this lady, and he still loved her. This misfits of misfits, and he still loved her. And he called her. He loved her so much, he called her out of that life. People yearn to be known and still be loved. That's why sometimes it gets messy, folks. You introduce people to the gospel and they don't buy in yet, but you still love them because they have to, in their humanity and fallenness, really believe that you love them unconditionally. And when they're convinced, then they'll open up to the gospel. But what a great message. Hey, come here. I got a guy who knows everything I ever did. I always wondered if the mayor said, does he know anything about us? You know, evidently she was pretty much with everybody, in the, you know, all the males in the community. But how do the people respond? Do you remember? They come. They come to Jesus. Of course, the disciples are bewildered. How did this all happen? There's some things you just can't explain. But I love the message of the Messiah, and I love the message about the misfits. We watch every year the good old cartoons. This is one that came out when I was a boy. Rudolph, you ever seen that? What's the highlight? Well, it's not when Rudolph's nose goes red. It's at the very end when they go back to the island of the misfit toys. I mean, it's even become a cliche now, the island of misfit toys. They go back, and they get them to take in the girls and boys who will unconditionally love them. Rudolph, the gospel tract. You never thought that. You just thought it was a story about a reindeer. No. Because yet again, you have a story that expresses the deepest yearnings of people. More people than you'd ever know feel themselves misfit. And they yearn to be part of a community that would have them. And so that's why you introverts who feel unqualified are actually the most effective evangelists, because I guarantee you, as great as Holly Lake is, there are people who consider themselves misfits. And you, and your subtleness, and your shyness, can actually be the perfect communicators of the gospel message, a message you cannot force people into, you can only invite people into. A story and a community. Does any of this make sense? Does any of this give you joy? I would hope so. Matter of fact, I hope it gives you glee. Glee that is willing to express God's love everywhere. All right? Let's stand and let's sing.